Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Hey, everyone. It's Asten Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your jamming on U Street of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica. Clarify, I have been on U Street. Mm-hmm. I'm not totally appropriating U Street culture.
U Street has just been appropriated for a few years now. So don't worry, man.
If anything, I'm late to that. Yeah. But we're on U Street today because we're talking about jazz, and we're talking about jazz in 2018. This is the first podcast of 2019, but we are looking back for our final year in review to talk about everything that happened in the world of jazz. And because we're talking about jazz, we're talking with Gio Russinello. Hey, Gio.
What's up, John?
Gio covers jazz from the New York Times. On the phone from D.C., maybe near U Street. I can't speculate.
There you go.
John Murph is here. He is a journalist and a DJ. He writes for Jazz Times, Jazzwise, Downbeat, NPR Music, a variety of places. Hey, John.
Hi, how are you?
Good, man. And we're going to look back. We have some big themes to talk about. We lost some very important people this year. We're going to start with where we just did with Wayne Shorter. That was a song called Pegasus off of Eminon, which was Wayne's most recent album. Not on Spotify, just FYI, for everybody who's rushing to Spotify. Gio, this was your number one album, number one jazz album of 2018. Talk to us about the god Wayne Shorter.
There it is. You said it. Wayne Shorter was just honored at the Kennedy Center Honors. Mm-hmm. Kind of a capstone moment for somebody who's gone through many phases and many iterations in terms of his career, but has always sort of been a constant and steady force of integrity and vision. And like, man, whatever Wayne is going to do is going to be on a certain level. Like, and I don't just mean of quality. I mean of kind of expansiveness and generosity of spirit and cosmic. You know, that's the word everyone always throws around with Wayne Shorter, because he's a dreamer and he's attuned to the cosmos. The album is called Eminon, and it was
three discs,
triple disc, whether on LP or CD, but like you said, not available digitally.
Yep.
Came with a lengthy graphic novel that he created with Monica Sly and Randy DeBerk, a couple of collaborators. He was drawing as a kid before he was playing the saxophone. He was always fascinated with science fiction, and this is kind of a really rare view into the creative mind of this tireless, endlessly ambitious, and idealistic thinker, somebody who represents in big, grandiose, kind of ephemeral ways what jazz is all about, as well as creating some of the most rigorous and grounded and powerful music just from a pure virtuosity standpoint. So this record is his quartet, which he's held together for almost two decades now, Daniel Perez, John Patitucci, and Brian Blade, joined by a chamber orchestra doing really, I would say, stuff that sounds very much within the Wayne Shorter tradition sonically, but approaches horizons that he hasn't before, at least not with this quartet.
John, what was your vibe on this Wayne record?
Well, for me, it was, I have a rich personal history with Wayne's music. He's my favorite composer. And what I love about this particular record was it was so fantastical. It was like black fantastical music. And a lot of those melodies I remember from college, my freshman year in college, Mississippi State University. Atlantis was one of my favorite records. And it was before I really kind of dwell into becoming a music journalist. I just dug the record. And while I listened to that record, I was also really reading all the comic books, X-Men, the Avengers, and all that. And it was interesting because I had paired those two together, like Wayne's evocative, very cinematic type music and comic books before I knew that that was something that he did. I kind of got into him pairing that with the album that came after Atlantis, which was Phantom Navigator. And if you get the LP, in the inner sleeve, he actually drew some comics, and I didn't understand. Well, I had no idea what was going on with it, but it was fascinating. I was enthralled by his willingness to do that, even though, you know, the plot was very loose. And then the third album that he did in the 80s, it was Joyrider, along with Terry Lane Carson and Jerry Allen and Patricia Rush. The back cover, Wayne Shorter did the artwork. So I knew there was something very cinematic and very graphic novel about him. And it was years later, and I was happy to hear him state his love for graphic novels and comic book heroes and all that. There are so many things to dwell into that record. And considering that that album came out later this year, if this makes sense, I love this album. But I'm not sure I know how much I love it. Every time I listen to it, I'm enthralled. Like, I can't do hardly any other thing except listen to this music.
Right. And I come it's that tactile. Can I ask a question about the comic book or the graphic now? Because I haven't seen it.
Yeah.
Is it a hero narrative? Is it ambivalent about hero narratives? Like, how does it relate to the broader universe of comics? And then, John, to pick up on what you were saying, you sort of identify Wayne in kind of this black fantastical tradition. I wonder about those intersections, because obviously we're seeing a lot of that pop up in the actual comic book and comic book extended universe this year, especially.
Yeah.
So I'd like to hear about those things in dialogue, if they are.
I had to read the comic book again, the graphic novel, but it was very Mothership Connection and very Brother from Another Planet thematically. You know,
low key classic. Go watch that if you haven't seen it. Low key.
You know, it's you know, just this whole idea of like someone coming to the earth and what that's going to do for humanity.
I do think it was in touch very much with the heroic ideal. And there's been conversations. I know, just to invoke her name without her being here, unfortunately, Michelle Mercer, who wrote Wayne Shorter's biography, posted a thing on Facebook and said, you know, I've got a problem with people saying Wayne is heroic because he's so much more than that. He's also nuanced and communal and all that. And I love that point. So I wish maybe in the future she'll be here and we can have that conversation. I do think there is a role for the heroic narrative around Wayne Shorter, which is an easy one to go to, but Eminon, the name of the record, is the name of the superhero figure in the comic book. He's sort of an anti-hero because he's an everyday citizen who discovers that he, together with others, has the power to sort of right this broken world. We're in like a dystopian future in this comic book. But I do think that, like, when John Merv, you talk about listening to the record and being so transfixed by it, there's something heroic about Wayne Shorter's ability to write melodies that are so strong that, okay, maybe we're dealing with whatever, 20, 30 musicians on stage together, these enormous string parts, these sort of flights of improvisation going every way, the cut open underbelly of the rhythm section in Wayne Shorter's quartet. But the melody catches you and holds you. And that is almost, they're so soaring and they're so powerful, it is almost heroic to me. And it relates to that comic book narrative.
There's something very sweeping about it. And I think another thing I really like about this record is it shows how, it's the word malleable, but I want to use it. Because I remember, you know, looking back, you know, Atlantis, Phantom Navigator, and Joyrider, they, you know, a lot of critics hated those. And a lot of times people are listening to the instrumentation. And sometimes listening to the instrumentation and listening to the melody can be totally different. I was a bit agnostic about the instrumentation. Like, I didn't, you know, I come from the 70s. I didn't grow up hating synthesizers, you know?
Right.
But it's interesting listening to that record. And it's like, I can listen to, like, I think the Three Marias, and I can, like, in my mind, hum out how I heard it on the record. And some of those melodies are so intact. And I think that shows you how great his writing was then. And to now, it's like, this is, you know, he has this philosophy of like, no composition is never finished, but it illustrated the power of that music back from back then.
Yeah.
That so many people kind of discarded. It's kind of like the way people are doing with Herbie Hancock's Sunlight album. Like, oh, Sunlight, everyone hates that record. And like, you have this whole legion of people now who's, that's their like lodestar for like music.
Well, I think this is a perfect sort of segue into what's going on these days, because so much of the jazz that's being made by, or the music, let's say, that's being made by jazz-trained musicians who are in their 20s, 30s, and 40s.
Careful distinction.
There you go. Is deeply inspired by those records you're talking about, the Herbie Hancock records from the 70s and even the 80s, records that Idris Muhammad was making or Lonnie Liston Smith was making, the Crusaders even, you know, like albums that come out of maybe a Los Angeles jazz tradition that we need to give its historical due.
So who are some of the younger musicians that you're talking about?
Talking about Micaiah McRaven, most obviously. A lot of Esperanza Spalding's new record, which she keeps going just around the internet saying, remember, this isn't jazz.
Well, it's funny. That was my pivot was going to be to Esperanza.
Yes.
Both for the ideas, but also because she works with Shorter and has worked with Shorter. Let's play something off of the new Esperanza record. Let's play the song that was in your playlist, Fang.
Beautiful.
And this is from the new Esperanza Spalding album. It's called 12 Little Spells.
You best believe you came in with a real thing. Your own getting way of walking in this simulated world. Kind of grease in the fulcrum of your inner space. That's your thing. You've got yours and I've got mine. Seat of the world inside.
Okay, so Esperanza has been saying, yes, like, clarify that, like, and walk people through why that matters, because many of the people who are listening to us today maybe don't understand the big picture of why that matters.
The question of, is this jazz?
Yes, or of her in this moment in her career with her training, making what she's making, saying that.
I don't know why, of the many possible reasons she might feel the need to distance herself from the word jazz. Maybe it's out of deference to those who are making music that's more closely aligned with whatever sort of the central spine of the tradition is, mm-hmm. and saying, I'm not trying to step on their toes. I'm doing my thing. I don't want to be burdened mm-hmm. with the expectations that come with being labeled jazz. Maybe it's simply a sonic thing. Maybe she understands jazz to be swinging or to be acoustic or
do you experience this album as jazz?
I've given up on that, honestly. I mean, my list was labeled a jazz list. Mm-hmm. I'm asked to cover jazz, but it's really impossible to put a bounding box around this stuff. Mm-hmm. So I just go by who's trained in that tradition and who's come from that community, because I think all we are is you know, a manifestation of
our
whence
influence.
We come,
yeah,
you know.
Course.
So that's really what it comes down to. And we can get into what systems are in play these days mm-hmm. furthering the jazz tradition, because that's a big conversation. Like, is it local communities? Is it conservatories? Is it parent-to-child mentorship? There are a lot of different delivery mechanisms these days for the tradition, but I do think it much more matters, did you grow up idolizing the jazz tradition and learning it as best you could, and then go do your thing.
Right. That's wayward child of tradition. It's interesting because you talked about Micaiah. You mentioned Micaiah McRaven just before Esperanza. Do you, and John, you as well, do you guys see them as engaged in a similar meta project, or are they doing it differently?
Between Esperanza Spalding and Micaiah McRaven?
Yeah, in terms of their relationship with what you just described as like, or you termed as the spine of the tradition.
Both are developing their craft, like in the information age. And I think what those musicians have to the advantage than musicians who came before them is just a wealth of information. And, you know, people learn differently now. There's the conservatory, there's the learning on the bandstand, then there's like crate digging, you know. There's a whole lot of jazz tradition that you can absorb that hasn't been yet accepted by the formal education, like going back to like Herbie Hancock's Secrets, that, okay, your professor might say this is a bad example of fusion, but you go to a DJ set and you can hear it differently. I think like listening to a DJ play records has a way of shaping how you absorb and learn music and how you interact with it. And I think both of them have grown up just in that situation where they're able to access different genres, different methods of applying music and playing music and shaping things that we have yet to come up with new terms for.
Yes.
And it's almost like technology, you know, the whole idea of like a lot of technology, you know, how you apply it or how you create policies for it come way after the technology is out there.
So we're doing a lot of retroactive work, or we will be doing a lot of retroactive work.
We're going to be doing a lot of retroactive stuff. Like, oh, that is jazz.
That's
oh,
interesting. Yeah. So. And I'm glad you actually talked about DJs, because something that came up for me when I was listening to some of these younger musicians, Geo, that were on your list and have been for the last few years, I think has come up in a couple of the pieces that you've written this year, also including the big band piece, which we'll get to, was the idea of jazz as dance music. Mm-hmm. And sort of not recentering it, but kind of embracing its history as dance music and also its potential future as mm-hmm. dance music. Mm-hmm. And certainly when I was listening to, is this where I get to talk about Theon Cross?
Yeah, let's do it.
Oh my gosh, for sure. I'm so excited.
Yeah.
Okay. So particularly, I was excited to hear a song on a compilation called We Out Here, which is not on your top 20 list, but I found it anyway.
And John
damn it.
Murph did write about it.
Did? Oh, okay. Murph, I want to read that. I didn't even catch that. So this compilation is called We Out Here. You want to talk, John, about what this compilation is, and then we're going to play a song from it?
Sure. I was actually there when the first day of recording for that in London. It was in August at the Fish Factory. The We Out Here is a compilation, and it's interesting when it came out, because it was like in 1987, That was a great compilation of British jazz artists by the Jazz Warriors. It's called Out of Many One People. And okay. That record came out in 87. It was on Antilles. And even though Courtney Pine was already out there, it kind of helped introduce people like Courtney Pine, Opie Robinson, Cleveland Watkins, Steve Williamson to the greater jazz community. And it was decidedly Black British jazz musician. Mm-hmm. And you could hear how they were channeling music from various West Indian Caribbean islands, as well as a lot of West African rhythms. And it was also still had elements of what we call American, like straight ahead. And there was something very distinctly British about it. We Out Here kind of mirrors that.
That era in the UK, that's the era that gives us Soul to Soul. That's the era that gives us effectively what we think of as like straight no chaser culture, sort of like proto acid jazz and things like that. So a lot of that sort of alchemical stuff that's happening in the mid 80s, Caribbean traditions, dance floor traditions, proto electronic music, all that stuff kind of coming together. This is all like a very fertile thing that's happening in England, 1986 through 1990, basically.
And that's sort of reflecting on like a reflection of what we just discussed about the United States recovering its forgotten electronic and dance-oriented music on the divide, whether it's Patrice Rushen or Herbie Hancock, on the divide between, you know, R&B, top 40, and jazz in the 70s and 80s. So anyway,
like
you're saying, John Murphy.
Now, We Out Here. Sorry. Go back in.
Yeah, so We Out Here, you know, a lot of those musicians that came out of We Out Here came out of the Tomorrow Warriors, which came out of the Jazz Warriors. So it was a lot of Tomorrow Warriors, as well as how they kind of developed their own performance-based around Jazz Refresh and Steve's. And these are like places that definitely intermingled DJ culture with live jazz and like stuff like broken beat, pulse drum and bass, grind. When you listen to that record, it was like a great time capsule.
It really felt that way. And it felt like so specific. And the song that I actually want to play off of it is Broccoli, which is Theon Cross plays tuba. And let's just play it. Let's just run it from the start, and then I'll talk about it afterwards. So this is Broccoli by Theon Cross. Obviously, I love this record because it's a grime record. When I first heard it, I was like, oh, I get it. Mm-hmm. And I'm obviously partial to the tuba. I played trombone in high school. Shouts out to the Stuyvesant High School Concert Band, 1991 through 1993. You know, this is it's a sound I'm sympathetic to, but this is an ideology that I'm sympathetic to, and I was so excited to hear it. Obviously, tuba is like a very underserved instrument, broadly speaking, but one of the real gifts every year when we do this look back in jazz, I get to discover things that I otherwise wouldn't have crossed my plate. And this was the thing I was most excited about. So this compilation, for all the reasons, John, that you described earlier, felt very 2018 to me. It was part of these larger dialogues about jazz in conversation with dance floor music. And also I think sometimes, at least in this country, jazz that sort of tries to engage with the current moment of hip hop often feels desiccated and thin. This did not feel that way to me at all. The texture of this was like incredibly robust, and I was really pumped up by it.
Yeah. Theon Cross is also sort of the meat and the bone.
When we go into Theon Cross show.
I've been.
I want to go.
to center it in that live experience, because that's really what this is all about, he is the kind of the animating force in Sons of Kemet, which is probably the most lauded, the most broadly known of the new British jazz groups. And it's got Shabaka Hutchings, who gets much more attention, partly because he's a brilliant musician. He happens to play the tenor saxophone, which is a much more protagonistic instrument.
Right.
He's a great talker and a great thinker and somebody who understands his music as an ideological, like you said, sort of an ideological force as well as a musical one.
And they had an album this year. Sons of
Kemet. They released a great album this year, and they did a tour all over the place. I mean, they were here in the States in a variety of cities, and they were playing a lot back home in the UK.
It's not on your list, Gio.
It's not on my list. I thought it was a very good record. I thought the live show was even better. Mm-hmm. They've got two drummers as well as Theon Cross, and there is no question that it gets people moving and that it's about filling the space with energy, sweat, movement, dance.
And this album in particular, again, and we'll talk about the big band thing you wrote about. But this album also really reminded me. I lived in London in the mid to late 90s, so I was catching the tail end of a lot of the early 90s club culture in which jazz fragments were being filtered through club culture. This album very much took me back and felt very similar to a lot of what I was experiencing in that time.
Shabaka Hutchings does this thing with his tenor saxophone where he actually uses it almost like a DJ's air horn.
Mm.
He does a piano kind of sound, and I'm like, oh yeah, that's where that comes from. You know, that comes from the dance floor. I did some research into that sound. It started in Jamaica.
Yep,
of course. It came It came to Britain, and now it's in the saxophone. Yeah. You know,
should we play something off of the Sons of Kemet record just to give people a taste of it?
For sure, man. They're all so good.
I know. I'm really partial to the early parts of the record.
I like My Queen is Harriet Tubman. Yeah, what do you like?
I love that song. Yeah.
Okay, great.
All right, let's do My Queen is Harriet Tubman. This is Sons of Kemet. We've mentioned it a couple times already. We're talking about jazz as dance floor music. Maybe yes, maybe no. Or it's sort of constant reckoning with the dance floor. And Gio, you wrote a piece not that long ago about the resurgence of the big band and big band as a dance floor tradition. And I wonder if you could talk about jazz and dance through the years.
Well, so this is going to be interesting because we're going to take, if we go down this route, we're going to take a format that was invented by dance bands.
Yes.
And has not been a dance format for 60 years.
Right.
And is not really coming back to it right now. But is a nice, interesting foil with an interesting historical thread, right? Mm-hmm. The jazz big band was America's first pop music, basically.
Yes, it was.
In the era of early radio, in the 20s and 30s, jazz was the first youth craze. It was the first thing that kids were going out and smoking marijuana and scaring their parents with. Right? It was like not what you think
reefer,
of now.
Reefer music.
It was reefer madness music. And
Maple Leaf Rags.
Yeah, exactly. That was the beginning of this big band, which is kind of insane. The durability of this format, this unwieldy thing with mm-hmm. four trombones, four saxophones, you know, tenor, baritone, alto, four trumpets, a rhythm section. Hard to get that kind of band together.
Yeah.
And it went pretty much swiftly out of style in the late 1940s for a variety of reasons, among them that it was cheaper and easier to get a
sure.
small group. Jazz became a more intellectual cafe music. It became less of a pop music. Rock and roll and R&B stepped in to make things brief and
right.
productive. But the jazz big band didn't go away, and it instead sort of became this playground for brilliant composers and arrangers. Gil Evans, Stan Kenton, and the later years of Duke Ellington Thad Jones. These were people who used the big band for its sonic potential. You know, for its textures, for its ability to interweave rhythms through different horn sections. It was no longer playing dance music. And that continues today. What's interesting to me, to make it current, and the reason that I wrote the piece, is that it was always going on that people like Thad Jones, Mel Lewis were having their, and Bob Brookmeyer were composing for these bands and doing what it took to put those bands on stage.
Mm-hmm.
But there hasn't been a surfeit of big band activity like there is now
yeah.
in decades. And the reason, you can almost say without a shadow of a doubt, is that a lot of very brilliant young composers are coming out of conservatory programs that fostered that kind of thinking and that kind of musical ambition on the page, really, which is where these
mm-hmm.
compositions often begin.
Mm-hmm.
And now they got to put it somewhere.
Why are conservatory programs still, even though this is not sort of the center of what's happening in jazz for the last 50 years, explain to me as a novice, why is that still a big part of the conservatory training?
Ooh, that's a really good question. To answer glibly, I think
yeah.
just because they're focused on the history and the past and
mm-hmm.
making sure people know their fundamentals. And there's a certain system that works that you can teach. But what do you think, John Murph?
When you teach formal music, there is the written note,
mm-hmm.
and the celebration of the written note. And I think just the amount of students coming in, it's like they have to learn how to play together. I think it's like a rites of passage for a lot of musicians.
That's
I would
a good
imagine.
Point. Yeah, even as a section musician, like not as a composer, but to be able to play the parts cleanly and with feeling and in a way that's not going to disrupt the whole is definitely something that you're right. I think a lot of musicians can tell, oh, has she played in a big band? Because he played in a big band? Oh, I can tell. They can really mm-hmm. hit their parts like that.
Do you guys find the music that's coming out of this new wave of big band music, is it historically reverent? Is it forward-looking? Is it programmatic? Is it not programmatic? Where does it fall on the sort of spectrum?
It's interesting because I think when you try to think of what's current, I don't think there's one particular sound that's current. I think because you have someone like Esperanza, and you have someone like Cecile, and you know
Cecile McLaurin. On one level,
and one level you can say that they're like decades apart, but they're both very, very relevant.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think so many different voices and so many different eras right now can exist on the whole platform and still be contemporary.
I think, you know? Yeah. To answer your question, John, I think that that's almost a good definition of what makes a jazz musician, somebody who can be both reverent to the tradition and hungry for the future. I think Brian Krock is somebody who released a really promising debut with sort of relatively standard format big band. He has some funky stuff thrown in there. But in terms of just recapping 2018, I'd say he's one of the people who put out a fabulous big band album.
Do you want to listen to something off of his album?
Let's throw something in there. I mean, the other names that I'd like to get off my tongue here are Miho Hazama, who's
mm-hmm.
a really great
mm-hmm.
composer. She did
yeah.
not release an album, at least not that I can think of, with her group in 2018. She's got something coming soon, though, in the next few months. Also, Jihei Lee is a great composer. Anna Weber and Shannon Baker have a big band that's been doing very interesting things here in New York and are going to release an album soon, the Terrassa Big Band. So those are just a quick sample of the many great big bands that are coming out of a tradition that's been honed for them in the last few decades, descending really from Thad Jones, by Bob Brookmeyer, by Darcy James Argue.
John Hollenbeck.
Yes, totally. Hollenbeck, who had one of my favorite albums of this year. He's not in that like 20s and 30s generation. He's a little older, but his album this year, I think, sets a high standard with his John Hollenbeck Large Ensemble. It's called All Can Work, and that's worth hearing too. But yeah, sure, let's listen to the Brian Krock album.
What do you want to hear?
So he had this suite called Tamal Pais, which was at the heart of his record. The album is named for the big band. It's called Big Heart Machine. And I really like the very first introductory piece in the suite, Tamal Pais 1, parentheses, Stratus.
This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Okay, so we've been talking a little bit about conservatory training, which is kind of a cousin to another thing that came up a little bit this year, which is talking about sort of institutions, the Stone moved into an academic setting. Mm-hmm. The Stone, if you have not been in New York, was a scrappy little room in the Lower East Side.
Yes, indeed.
Where I've had I almost passed out one night many years ago.
Because of the sound or because of the heat?
It was a combination of the two. The only times I've ever had really bad experiences at concerts have been combinations of heat slash humidity
and free jazz.
Yes, basically. And like intense throbbing music. Actually, there are two other times. Mm-hmm. One was with Godspeed You Black Emperor.
So not unrelated. They're trying to make you sick a little bit.
Yeah, and Sigur Rós.
Oh, yeah.
But it was at the Stone. I can't remember what it was. And
so this was the only time that's happened to you and you haven't been on psilocybins, you're telling me.
Yay. Okay, cool. Hey, it's 2019. clean. 29 clean is where we're at. So, but it definitely happened at the Stone, which was not well ventilated when I went.
Nope.
And maybe got late. Yeah. Maybe in later years it was better ventilated, but I went early.
Nope.
I really enjoyed seeing music there the few times that I went.
Uh-huh.
And I was, in a weird way, surprised to learn that it had become so much a part of the larger jazz, that it was going to become an institution in a formal sense.
In that it was going to move to the new school.
Yes.
Yeah.
So can you talk about what underpins that and what does that actually mean for, does that destabilize what we think of as institution, or should that destabilize what we thought of as the Stone for 13 years?
Both.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
But it maybe not destabilizes what we think of as the institution of the Jazz Academy. Maybe it just emboldens and strengthens and makes even more pervasive the kind of hegemony of the jazz educational landscape, which is to say people who can pay largely to go to conservatories are the ones who get the opportunities to learn from the so-called greats and the ones who are increasingly being invited to determine the music's future. And that's what we see with the big bands that I'm talking about, which is not to say that the music they're creating isn't beautiful.
Right.
But it's to say that
it's a product of a specific
set of
opportunities.
The future, the determinative power of young musicians is increasingly being concentrated in the Academy.
Yeah.
And for the Stone to move into the Academy is very interesting, because it's taking music that has resolutely existed outside of a certain academy. At the same time, John Zorn has always been very clear about the fact that, first of all, he's not trying to do jazz. He's trying to do what he considers American concert music.
Mm-hmm.
And that includes freely improvised stuff coming out of a German serialist tradition, as much as it includes stuff coming out of an Anthony Braxton tradition, there's overlap there, and as much as it includes stuff coming out of William Parker's, you know, New York free jazz revolutionary music scene.
And also maybe with like little flickers of art rock.
Oh, yeah.
There.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I definitely saw like a weird TV on the radio side project.
Yeah, no, I mean, Thurston Moore, you know, will be at the Stone here and there. But it's just interesting that he wants to and is now bringing that, all of that energy and all of what has long been a grassroots kind of musical activism embodied on stage and in the music, bring that into the Academy. And
does it undermine it?
Hey, man.
Oh, sure.
I see the rictus on Gio's face.
What do you think, John Murph?
John Murph, what do you think, man?
It's almost like the pros and cons of gentrification.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I'm all about, like, you know, better working conditions environmentally for musicians.
Sure.
And I don't think the Stone's being swept up by a formal music institution is going to take away the independent venues propping them. I think that both spots will always prop up, you know. So I think you can enjoy both in both worlds. Because when I was at the Stone, when I was there, and I saw Nicole Mitchell, you know, it wasn't like, okay, I'm going to the Stones and now I'm hearing Boscaz now. Like, you know, that was not the case.
You mean the new one at the new school?
Right, yeah, exactly.
Right. No, they haven't left
just
behind.
Just you wait. Boz Skaggs retrospective 2021 at the Stone.
Mark Knopfler, Bill Frisell duo could kind of work, you know?
Yeah.
So, I don't even get these jazz jokes, but I know they're funny.
Thanks for the laugh.
So, and no disrespect to him, but what I'm saying is, it's not like, you know, there was like this jazz and jazz completely disappeared, which we've seen. Like, we've all seen the jazz festival in which the most jazzish it got was maybe Jill Scott at the Jazz Festival.
Right.
So that did not happen.
Right. No, and that's not
so
going
far
to happen. I think what it does is it simply kind of doesn't necessarily complete, but it definitely it follows in the cycle or along the trajectory, I should say, that John Zorn has wanted to follow, which is to move this radical outsider music into the space of the concert hall and into the space of general acceptance by the artistic powers that be. And there is a victory there. But what it also does is it opens up the vast terrain that the grassroots activism often happens on for other people to step in. And, you know, John Zorn is not in his 20s and 30s anymore, and he's not that generation anymore. Right. So that's great. You know, this in that way, it can be celebrated as a major victory because there's this sense a lot of the time on the avant-garde that we need to covet resources. Mm-hmm. But his, you know, being swept up into the academy doesn't necessarily mean that now that's the only place that people are going to go to hear avant-garde music. I think there's actually a very, for a lot of reasons, related to the spread of information and mm-hmm. the opening up of self-determination of the listener and saying, oh, I like this just because I like it, not because it's on the radio, not because whatever. We're in an era when there's a huge appetite for avant-garde sure. expression, whether it's in film or in music or whatever.
So we don't have to get too preoccupied with how one particular institution is disposing of itself.
Yeah.
One theme that came up, and this is something we talked about a little bit before we started recording, and this has a little bit to do with institutions, but it's maybe a little bit more adjacent to that, was this idea, Gio, you mentioned kind of a little bit of an ideological malaise that's setting in, and you talked about, we have Kamasi now. We have basically jazz or jazz-rooted musical folk heroes who have begun to take on a life outside of jazz communities. And that seems to only be growing mm-hmm. year over year. And I wonder if you can talk about the pros and the cons of that.
It's a lot. I mean, I think that you've said it well. I think the idea of jazz folk heroes being welcomed by a mainstream media that is interested in young, hip wisdom yeah. figures.
Yeah, sure.
Politically attuned artists.
Right.
And people who can tap into a long history while also sounding very contemporary and cool. And jazz is providing that. There have long been those kinds of figures.
Well, I was just going to say, to be clear, jazz has always had those figures.
Yep.
People have chosen to pay attention or not pay attention.
Exactly. And there have always been those who were more accepted in the mainstream than they were within the jazz tribe, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And jazz really is its own meritocratic community. And just I just sense in candid conversations yeah. with musicians whom I speak to as friends or as mm-hmm. just, you know, people that I'm hanging with at a show, not on the record.
Yeah.
And musicians who I'm close enough with that they'll tell me what other musicians are saying to them.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
That's the kind of place where I start to hear, man, there's so much jive stuff out there. Like,
yeah, sure.
we're really like wondering when the journalists are going to wake up and see that so-and-so is really not hitting as hard as these other people who sure. are not getting coverage. There's always that. But I think now especially...
Haters. No, I'm just kidding.
Right.
I'm just kidding.
But, like, there's this sense of, like, self-policing.
Yeah. Which always happens. Mm-hmm. And that's, like, that's not particular to jazz.
No.
That's true of hardcore. That's mm-hmm. true of hip-hop.
Yeah.
That's true of country.
Exactly.
I mean, this is anything right. which is premised upon an internal logic, but occasionally gets mm-hmm. external validation. This tradition is as long as music itself.
And like, it's a good problem to have, yeah. probably. Mm-hmm. But, John Murphy, I'm interested
yeah.
what you
yeah,
think
what do you
of
think, John? What does it cause you tension when folks like Kamasi or Mackay or whoever start getting more noise outside than inside?
I'm always happy for them. You know, we need our stars.
But are they the right stars?
For now, yes, I guess. You know, before there was Kamasi, there was Robert Glasper. I loved him.
Yep.
Before Kamasi, there was Gregory Porter. There was Donna Crawl. I think it's a matter of how they articulate their history and the music, and to let people know that they didn't come bursting out of like a star in some unknown galaxy. You know, they kind of talk about where they came from. You know, Kamasi talks a lot about Gerald Wilson and the L.A. scene, and his ascension has enabled other people from his crew in L.A. to get recognition. So, you know, I think that's a good thing. It's a good thing. Like, the ones we're talking about, I don't think they are coming on the scene saying they have, you know, reinvented the wheel or anything like that.
Right.
You know? So I'm happy for them. In terms of the haters, I definitely heard, you know, people made snide comments about Kumasi not coming out of New York and then come through the, you know, the New York trenches and totally disregarding what trenches are available in.
Yeah, right.
Los Angeles, in LA.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, he played in Gerald Wilson's big band. It's like, doesn't that count for something?
You know? Right.
Yeah, I tend to, maybe I'm optimistic. You know, I'm all about people, you know, being able to get a level of attention where they can take care of themselves. Like, you know, constantly being on the edge. You know, it's hard being on the edge when you got bills to pay.
Right.
You know, I'm all about people being able to make some level of living and being able to turn other people on to stuff.
Yes.
I've seen it happen in other pop genres where there's this sense that only one person gets the shine, or there's only room for one success story or crossover or breakthrough at a time. And I've always found it to be really short-sighted, because what I think something like that does is it expands a lot of people's perspectives. And then the more people have their perspectives expanded, the more opportunity it creates down the line for both, number one, other people to experience similar success working in similar frameworks, but also to make entirely new forms and new connections and new ideologies. And that's something that wouldn't happen if you didn't have people who were breaking free of the kind of spine of tradition, as it were.
I think I'm pretty receptive to the rising tide theory.
I mean, I just feel like the types of dialogues that can happen with folks who are doing that. John, you mentioned Gregory Porter, then you said Diana Krall, which is maybe a leap I personally was not prepared to make. but you know, I'm going to defer to y'all. If y'all say it fits, then that hat gets worn.
Yeah.
But in the big picture, I don't know. I guess I've always seen it as potentially the long run benefits outweigh the short term tensions. I'm also not a musician trying to pay my bills.
You know, it's also one of the things where it's like, it's a catch and two. It's no, I've seen cats in the jazz world bemoan, like, I don't like the Grammys because, you know, the jazz not, you know, getting performed and it's getting ignored. Then you have someone like, say, Kumasi or like Greg Porter. If they kind of inch the way in which they're performing at the Grammys and they get some recognition, then it comes this hate. Look at them, who they think they are.
Right, right.
Look at them, singing jazz and stuff. Right?
Well, I guess what I would say to those people is, no one likes the Grammys. Like, the Grammys, if the Grammys is a touchstone for anything, it should. The Grammys operates the same place in relationship to practically every genre of music.
Everything, yeah. Yes.
So whatever jazz folks are saying at the Grammys, country folks are saying about it, hip-hop folks are saying about it, hard rock folks are saying about it, Latin music, like literally, like the idea that it's only happening in jazz is just so far from the truth.
Yeah.
So if you're a jazz person who's listening to this and you're upset about the Grammys and you think you have exclusive purview over that, I hate to do this to you, but I'm going to take that away from you and say it's not just you.
Well, I love about people like Gregory and Kumasi and Makai. Those names resonate in some corners of like DJ culture. So it's nice being able to go to like a hip hop set or R&B set in which you can drop some of that and it doesn't clear the dance floor.
Right.
You know?
Yep.
Having those stars help break those down. You need those. We need our stars.
Okay, so let's listen to Kumasi. Kumasi had an album this year. It's called Heaven and Earth. It was his first album since the big breakthrough album, The Epic, a few years ago. So let's listen to Fists of Fury off of Heaven and Earth.
So this is an example of a jazz record with vocals, mm-hmm. a jazz record with words, and a jazz record that makes its intentions clear that way. And I think there's been a number of those albums this year and a number of projects, whether recorded or not, that use vocals and lyrics and poetry along with jazz instrumentals. And it's part of that conversation about touching the mainstream and speaking in a way that the everyday listener maybe can tune into. It's an important moment for jazz just because it's kind of having this moment of mm-hmm. broader acceptance. And I think we see some projects coming out where musicians are maybe in a direct response to that, maybe not, just taking the opportunity to speak really clearly and directly about what they're trying to say.
Yeah.
Ambrose Akinmusiri is one of the great trumpeters of our day, maybe the best. You know, if you ask a lot of musicians, mm-hmm. he's sort of the pace setter for the younger generation. He's in his mid-30s. And his album this year was one of my absolute favorites. It was called Origami Harvest. And it featured an MC, yep. Kool AD, who's
right.
been in the news for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, so just yep. as a quick side thing, Kool AD was accused of sexual assault recently.
I mentioned in my review of this album that it was great, but that he had a history of being accused of super uncool-ish.
The initial allegations go back many months.
There was actually years.
There were some recent ones as well.
Yeah, he was... The worst moments in the album are when he talks about, like, sex, mm-hmm. and where it feels like, what's going on? Yeah, why does this resonate wrong?
Yeah,
oh, it's because you're kind of a creep. That said, the album itself was incredibly well arranged mm-hmm. by Ambrose Akinmusiri.
Has he been asked about this? Has he talked about it?
He has not, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. And that's
not to my knowledge.
A no. problem.
Ambrose, email us. We're here for that conversation if you want
to. He's not the only jazz musician who's been working with Kool AD, and that's been interesting to me. Like, why is our community open to that?
Right, and not speaking about, right, and not pushing back.
Really, really monumental album, sullied by the involvement of this guy who spits some really serious poetry and also misses the mark in a lot of ways as a human being.
Certainly seems that way, yeah.
I was sitting there saying to myself, man, why did he do this? Why did he bring this guy in? You know, I'd also like to hear from other people with more nuanced or their own kinds of nuanced thinking about this, because maybe he's anti-canceling culture. Maybe he wants to say, you know, let's hear from this person anyway. Maybe he's saying...
Maybe he thinks no one will notice.
Maybe. Maybe he thought that the statute of limitations had passed.
I just think that sometimes people think that that transparency is a real cloak, and it's not.
Right.
If this is a choice you're going to make, it's an aesthetic choice, mm-hmm. and it's a political choice.
Exactly.
So...
He's throwing his weight behind...
Right. So we...
A person and an artist.
We have to ask people to stand up to their mm-hmm. political and aesthetic choices. So, again, hit the DMs, hit the email.
And to some degree, the virtuosity of some of the poetry redeems it. I mean, at least explains, not redeems, but explains why he made that choice. They obviously have a creative connection. But then there are moments where you sit there and you say, oh, like, no, this is not the right collaborator
right.
for this amazingly ambitious and otherwise pretty successful
Do you
project.
Think that a record as musically effective could have been made with a different collaborator?
I can only assume so.
Yeah.
But... There's never a what if, right?
No, sure.
But there is. And yeah, I would have liked that.
Yeah, sure.
Earl would have sounded great on this
There
record.
You go. A perfect example. I'd love to hear Earl on that.
Yeah. But let's listen to something less distasteful from the record.
Yes, go ahead.
Let's play a track on which Ambrose Akinmusiri does the talking.
Great.
It's called Free, White, and 21. And like previous pieces that he's put on other albums, it involves a roll call of those killed by the police.
Tyree Woodson. Victor White III. Yvette Smith. Jordan Baker. Danny Lopez. Miriam Gary.
Esperanza Spalding's album was fabulous and super ambitious, read like a philosophical treatise. It was trying to, as a palliative, as well as a piece of music, it was, each of the 12 tracks is devoted to a different part of the body. It was informed by her study of Reiki and other forms of, I guess, non-traditional, non-Western medicine, or very traditional, but non-Western medicine. Cecile McLaurin-Salvant both released an ambitious album called The Window and also put out or began to perform a new piece that she'd worked out with Darcy James Argue, the big band leader. The performance is called Ogress. But it's just interesting to me that, there's a lot of, that jazz is not missing the boat on the opportunity to speak about issues and to help us imagine a better future, not just with abstract expression in the form of instrumentals, but in terms of poetry and lyrics.
John, what do you think about that particular movement happening in current jazz and maybe how it connects historically to previous eras where that was a factor?
Well, there's definitely a history to it. You know, you definitely hear that, like, from Duke Ellington to, like, Max Roach. You got to think about the history of his use of poetry. You got, like, Jane Cortez. I think one of the recurring elements of this whole conversation is, like, this whole idea of building on an existing tradition. And, like, I think some of those traditions kind of fade in the background and they rise back up. And I think you're seeing more of that. I think you're seeing a lot of jazz artists using poetry and lyrics to articulate a lot of frustrations, a lot of ambitions, you know, coming not only from the Me Too movement, but the, you know, Black Lives Matter movement. You're seeing it post-Katrina, post-9/11, you know, you got to look at stuff that Vijay Iyer and Mike Ladd was doing, like, almost 19 years ago.
Wow, yeah. I forgot about that stuff. Shouts to Mike Ladd living in Paris, having a great life.
So the things that are like Ursula Rucker was doing with Four Heroes, we got to stop looking at these things as something new and just kind of like just connect the dots. So like, okay, this is something that's been going on. How viable is it? And how they're speaking to things that are going on today. So I don't see it particularly new. I feel that it's been vital. I definitely hear it's been vital.
Can we listen to something actually off of that old Vijay Iyer and Mike Ladd record just for no reason?
Sure.
Just because I haven't heard it in
a long
time.
Well, there's three.
I'm talking about they did together. In what language is the one?
Oh, that's a great one.
In what language, yeah.
Yeah. Should we just play the title track?
Sure.
Let's play the title track on In What Language, Vijay Iyer and Mike Ladd.
These digital ill-pixelated chips are sick. I find no rhythm in their paint. The celluloid that slipped through camera tips are relevant for satellites and quick immediate remedies. Chomping at the bits and pieces of our metered thoughts and rock the faces more like feet and youth. Still within the sights of horse and mouth, not foot and mouth disease. Unease has found its profit, I suppose. The news that I am now a criminal should not be news, but who will hear the innocence when eyes and lips and tongues are cast as rumor? I have made my living with my witness. Now I witness all the living disappear. And look outside the plastic oval window, I wonder if Zarathustra had it right. Because in this position, with wrists cuffed, my soul must seem as sick as colors fused on airline seats with flame-retarded weaves. I'm waiting for the cosmic bull to die, for Ahura Mazda's grin to light this earth and let the bovine's innards fertilize. I'm confusing times. It should come as no surprise. I'm handcuffed in a vessel that cheats day. While speeding west to east, we swallow night. If I catch one more eye-casting suspicion, my tongue will turn around and mind my stomach for just one word. If there's no language to explain, at least a word or a grunt. Disdain when facing innocence is madness. There's no word to explain this, for if there were, I could capture truth within a lens and screen the scenes to non-believers, and they would see, and they would touch, and they would hear me speak.
Okay, we are coming to the end of this episode, and we wanna go out remembering some of the folks that we lost in jazz this year and really celebrating their contributions. Those of you who listen to podcasts regularly know that we devoted an episode in the fall to Roy Hargrove, who died. Gio or John, do you guys want to say anything else about Roy? Because I do think Roy either has been present in some of the discourse we've been having over the last hour, explicitly or implicitly. I do think there's been some Roy in there.
Well, John Murph, you wrote a beautiful tribute / obituary to Roy Hargrove in Downbeat.
Yeah.
I'll let you take this one.
Roy's death, it hit me in the gut the same way Jerry Allen passing did in the jazz world.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it for me is because I knew the person behind the music. I got a chance to see the person. And that was what was painful about writing that. There are so many things I love about Roy. I think Roy he epitomized like the jazz torchbearer in so many fascinating ways. You know, he celebrated the past, the history. You know, he was very comfortable hanging in there with a lot of his elders. You know, he was definitely invited his elders to record with him. But he was also very contemporary without it looking like he was dressing up hip hop. Like I remember, yeah. I think it was his third album, The Vibe, in which he was like one of the first artists of that generation to like not wear a suit.
Right.
And when it came out, it wasn't like this obvious thing. It wasn't like Roy does hip hop. It was just The Vibe. And he always knew how to like imbue his music with contemporary R&B and hip hop without like needing to like have turntable scratches in there. I think that came out of his tenure with Bobby Watson and Horizon. You know, you listen to those early records. So Bobby always had this R&B vibe going underneath it without it sounding like a CTI record. And I love CTI records. And that's hard to do. That's hard to do, you know, to be funky without coming out for funk record. He had this great, I think it was his third Blue Note record. It's called Pulse Motown Bop. And I used to use that term for a lot of artists that were similar to Roy Hargrove.
Wow, that's perfect.
With Roy, you know, a lot of people talk about Roy and his hip-hop thing, and they start talking about D'Angelo and Erykah Badu and Common. I was hearing, like, really kind of more explicit hip-hop stuff towards the end of the 1990s when he had a band, and they were like, you know, instead of just playing trading fours, you know, one musician would like quote from, like, Rolls Royce, Car Wash, and then they were like, respond back with a quote from Ohio Players, Skin Tight. And there was like banter back and forth. And it was like this DJ thing going on without explicitly saying, okay, we're doing hip hop. A lot of times I talked to Roy backstage. We really didn't even talk about jazz history that much. And I've interviewed him several times, like outside of me interviewing him on the stage, we're like, we're both P-Funk fans. Both our favorite Parliament albums were Motor Booty Affair. And we talk about that. Those are the things I miss about Roy. You know, talking about like the difference between cornbread in Texas versus Georgia.
Should we touch on some other folks? Randy Weston, Nancy Wilson, Hugh Masekela. You want to talk briefly as we go out about them?
I would say all of those that you just mentioned were very painful losses this year. Randy Weston, one of the real luminaries in jazz. I mean, died in his 90s and had been an advocate for a kind of consciousness around where the music came from well before it was fashionable or even in any way accepted to say that this is an African music. Not simply that it was that jazz is a kind of utopian representation of black and white together, but his point was more, well, no, it's wonderful that others want to participate in the community and can appreciate the music and even sometimes make the music, but this is music that comes directly out of an experience of Africans in America, you know, and his music spoke to that beautifully. Nancy Wilson was a musician who understood jazz fundamentals and also understood jazz's ability to transcend whatever commercial boundaries might be laying around it and became one of the great vocalists of her time, in any genre. As a result, the album with Cannonball Adderley is essential for anyone who's trying to go back and rediscover Nancy Wilson. And Hugh Masekela was also somebody who understood the African identity of jazz, but in a more direct way, perhaps, because he was from South Africa and lived a life of activism and brought the music directly into conversation with the experience of resistance in a way that South African musicians in general in the 70s and 80s especially were better equipped to do because of their circumstance and because of their tradition than almost anybody else in the world. And he was, as a leader of the anti-apartheid movement, super important, both for his activism and his consciousness raising and his music.
It's like the closing down of a library. You know, you think about Randy Weston, you know, Randy Weston and Hugh Masekela and Nancy, the amount of jazz history that they embodied and the stories that they told verbally that never made it onto page. Those are the things that you miss. And you miss them as people, too. Like, Randy was, like, one of the most gracious men you can ever meet. Hugh Masekela, you know, these were, like, grand men who had all the accolades and all the wonderful things that they've done. They should be able to make anyone feel small in terms of meeting them, and they never did.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, you look at, you know, some of the artists now, they might have one hot MP3 out, and you know, they want you to, like, cross, like, a velvet rope just to get to them. And
speak on it. Speak on it, John. You let them know one MP3 doesn't mean nothing.
Right.
That's right.
And you look at...
That's right.
We look at someone,
we're not naming names, but we know who you are. You know who you are.
Yeah. And you see these people who really been through it. You know, you know, like, Hugh Masekela, not only do I have hot records, but yeah, I survived apartheid. Like, and you meet them and they embrace you.
I'd love to hear some Nancy Wilson at the end. Should we hear something from the Cannonball Adderley record?
I mean, for me, it's Never Will I Marry, but what do you think, John?
That song right there. That's my favorite song.
Yeah. That's dirty. Never Will I Marry. This is Nancy Wilson off of Nancy Wilson, Cannonball Adderley.
Never, never will I marry. Never, never will I wed. Born to wander solitary, wide my world.
That is our show this week. Thank you to our guests, Gia Russinello and John Murph. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us your thoughts on the year in jazz or next year in jazz or maybe 2 years from now in jazz at podcast@nytimes.com. And you could subscribe to the podcast, which you absolutely should do, anywhere you get your audio content, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, your podcast app, all these places. Our producer, back strong in 2019, Pedro Rosado, Headstepper Media, and we will be back next week.